All right, so this is Bio 160, and it's October 30th. We just had our third exam last time, and sorry about that one figure that was on the test. The very last one. So it was not one of your exam figures, so I just treated it as extra credit. So if anybody got any of those wrong, it didn't count against you. If you got any of them correct, it counted for you in a really big way, because I didn't divide by 75. I divided by 65 because there were 10 questions on there. Okay, so those grades I put on Blackboard Tuesday, so you should see what grades you have for that. But if you want to calculate where you stand in the class, then you have to see me during office hours or after class, and I can calculate how that all goes. Yeah. You know, I'm probably not going to turn the Scantrons back to you, but if you want to see those Scantrons, certainly you should take a look at them during office hours or something, or after class. Okay? So it's probably not a bad idea. All right. Second item is that we're scheduled to have a quiz this week, today, on blood in lecture. Okay? But we're not quite done with the blood chapter. And I suppose I wouldn't feel too bad about giving you a quiz in lecture, but what I've done, I've turned it into a take-home. So instead of taking a quiz in lecture today, I've decided to wreck your weekend instead. So I don't know what is better. All right, so make sure you turn the quiz in on Tuesday. Okay? So before you leave, don't forget, you got to pick up a quiz to do over the weekend. All right, so nobody's really going to leave early, right? Don't leave early until we pass that quiz out. All right, or if we finish the blood chapter, before I move on to the next chapter, I'll pass the quiz out. So I'm going to forget, so make sure you remind me. All right, so we're talking about blood, and blood has two major parts. Can anybody remember what the two major parts of blood are? It's plasma and formed elements. So plasma is the liquid part, formed elements is the cellular part, right? And so we talked about what is dissolved in plasma. There are a number of proteins, there are ions, nutrients, gases, various waste products. And the formed elements are made up of red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. And you should know what an alternative name for red blood cell is, what an alternative name for white blood cell is, and as well as for platelet. What's another name for a platelet? Yeah, thrombocyte, erythrocyte, leukocyte. Okay. And so you should sort of be aware of what those things look like. So here is what whole blood would look like underneath a microscope. You see the nice red blood cells. They don't have a nucleus. White blood cells have a nucleus. And these little platelets are really, really tiny, and these function in preventing blood loss. Another term that we use to characterize blood is a term called hematocrit. So if we take whole blood out of somebody and put it in a test tube and let it sit overnight, all the heavy stuff is going to float to the bottom, right? And the heavy stuff is what? Mostly the formed elements, and especially red blood cells. And if we measure the complete volume, 100% of the volume, that's going to be whole blood, but the formed elements down at the bottom are going to contain mostly red blood cells. And if we look at the volume of red blood cells compared to the total volume that we've taken out of somebody, that's what we call hematocrit. So if we look at this test tube right here, and we say that from the very bottom to the top layer right here, if that's 100%, how much as a percent is this volume of red blood cells? What does it kind of look like to you? Does it look exactly like 50? Not quite. It looks a little bit less, right? Okay. So that would be the hematocrit. It's maybe about 45%, right? And so that's a pretty typical number to have. Men might be a little bit higher because testosterone produces maybe a hematocrit of 46 or 47, right? Women, because they don't have the testosterone, plus they lose red blood cells every month, that hematocrit is going to be a little bit lower. All right, it might be about 44-45%, something like that. And if it deviates much more than that, then of course that signals a disease state. Okay, so be aware of hematocrit and maybe how to calculate it. Okay, so let's talk specifically about red blood cells. That's these guys right here, right? They don't have organelles, so they can't proliferate. They can't regenerate themselves. They have to come from a tissue that produces them. And the tissue that produces red blood cells is what we call bone marrow, and in particular, red bone marrow produces red blood cells. But once bone marrow produces a red blood cell, that's kind of a dead-end cell, and as a matter of fact, it doesn't live for very long. It only lives for about 120 days maximum because it doesn't have organelles, doesn't have a nucleus. It's pretty much destined to die. But while it is alive, it's loaded with a chemical compound that we call hemoglobin, and hemoglobin absorbs oxygen and transports oxygen in our body because, don't forget, mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. So that's the function of these red blood cells. And they're dark red in color because they're filled with that chemical compound called hemoglobin. Hemoglobin contains an iron molecule. That's what that Fe stands for. That's just a chemical symbol for iron. So we have to have iron in our diet, and especially females, not so much males, because males don't lose very much iron. Okay, so females are kind of protected from overdosing on iron, but men are really a lot more susceptible to overdosing on iron because men don't lose iron. All right, so hemoglobin is the compound that carries oxygen, but there are other things that can bind to hemoglobin. Here we see that hemoglobin can bind oxygen, and we call that oxyhemoglobin. Hemoglobin in red blood cells can also bind another chemical compound, and that's CO. Does anybody know what CO stands for? Carbon something. Carbon monoxide instead of carbon dioxide, which is what your body produces. But carbon monoxide can bind to hemoglobin to produce carboxyhemoglobin. And when carbon monoxide is bound to hemoglobin, oxygen can't bind to it. So what does that sound like to you? If you in your body have lots of hemoglobin, but it can't bind oxygen, what's going to happen to your body? It's going to starve to death because it doesn't have oxygen. Your body can't make ATP. What happens to all the functions in your body when you run out of ATP? Yeah, it stops functioning, you die, right? So carbon monoxide is a very potent kind of poison because it binds up the hemoglobin that's in your red blood cells, and your circulatory system can't transport oxygen, mitochondria can't make ATP, and it's a very lethal circumstance. The reason why carbon monoxide is so poisonous is because the stability of carboxyhemoglobin, which is what's formed when carbon monoxide binds to it, is 210 times more stable than the stability of oxyhemoglobin. That means when carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin to make carboxyhemoglobin, it doesn't like to ever let go. It just stays bound to hemoglobin. And that the hemoglobin then is pretty much really taken out of your circulation. So the antidote for carbon monoxide poisoning is breathing pure oxygen. So how many oxygen molecules, for instance, if there is this, so here we have a hemoglobin molecule right here, and we see that it has bound, what, a carbon monoxide molecule right here. So this molecule can't transport oxygen. In order to displace this carbon monoxide, how many oxygen molecules do I have to draw around here to get that carbon monoxide bonked off so that your blood will carry oxygen instead of this carbon monoxide? Take a guess. How many of these oxygens do I have to bind, put in here? I could be here all day. Yeah. 210 of them to get rid of that one carbon monoxide molecule. Right? So very low concentrations of carbon monoxide in the air that you breathe will poison your blood, right, and will stop those mitochondria from making ATP. So at very, very low levels, carbon monoxide is highly poisonous. And you know what? Usually around this time of year, there's always a case or two where somebody in Los Angeles or, you know, even in California is going to die of carbon monoxide poisoning, because where does carbon monoxide come from? we deal with it all the time, usually safely. But anytime you burn something, that produces carbon monoxide. So when you have your engine in your car turned on, it's producing carbon monoxide. Or if you turn on a stove or an oven, it produces carbon monoxide. Or a fireplace or a candle or something like that produces carbon monoxide. And the reason why it's a problem, because most of our furnaces at home burn something like gas, like natural gas. One of the byproducts of that is carbon monoxide. And if the furnace starts to misbehave, if the chimney gets blocked or something, then carbon monoxide leaks into the house or into the apartment. And when is it usually coldest? During the day or at night?
At
night, and that's when you're sleeping. And some people, when their furnaces don't work properly, they fall asleep and they just never wake up because that carbon monoxide builds up. All right, so that definitely happens. Another circumstance, so that's why I'm saying about this time of year, because about this time of year now it starts to get cold and people start to turn on their furnaces or whatever. Or if somebody doesn't have a furnace, they bring in something from the outside to heat up their apartment. Like what? Like a barbecue, for instance. And they'd light barbecue in their apartment to heat their, you know, it's not such a really big deal in LA because it doesn't get that cold, but if you lived in Chicago, New York City or something like that, you know, you would think of that because it's freezing cold inside your house. You wouldn't want that, right? And that carbon monoxide can really wipe out whole families. And there was the number one tennis player in the world a number of years ago died of carbon monoxide poisoning because his furnace where he lived in New York City stopped working correctly. And his name was Vidas Gerulaitis. Anybody remember Vidas Gerulaitis? No, it's probably a little bit before your time. But he was the number one tennis player in the world, and he died of carbon monoxide poisoning as a result of that, the furnace misbehaving. So it certainly does happen, and hopefully we won't hear a thing about it this year, but chances are something bad is going to happen to somebody as a result of that. That's the silent killer, because carbon monoxide doesn't have a color. It's odorless, so you can't smell it. And very, very low concentrations, even though it's low in the room, it can build up in your bodies because it grabs onto hemoglobin and just doesn't ever let go. Okay, unless it's specifically treated. All right. Okay, so we're talking about red blood cells. We're going to talk about white blood cells in just a little bit, okay? But let's consider first just red blood cells. That's these guys right here. We said they only live for about 120 days, all right, and then they die. So what does your body have to do? It has to replace them, and it's the red bone marrow that's responsible for doing that. And as a matter of fact, if they only live for about 120 days, there are a lot of them that die every day in your body, and as a matter of fact, every second, a lot of them die. And it's actually kind of an amazing statistic. So here it is. Every second, there are about 2.5 to 3 million die in your body. So how many does your body have to make every second? It has to make 2.5 to 3 million every second. So this is a very busy tissue. That's red bone marrow. And if red bone marrow can't make 2 to 3 million every second, what disease process do we call that? That's called anemia, right? So when your body isn't making red blood cells, you're going to have a lower level of red blood cells. We call that anemia. All right, so where is red bone marrow located? Where is bone marrow located? In long bones, right? That's in the medullary cavity of long bones, so that's deep inside of a bone. So I didn't draw the bone here, but I just kind of drew out what red bone marrow sort of looks like. Well, what do you need to make red blood cells? Not just red blood cells, but it also has to contain the chemical compound that is transporting oxygen. That's what we call hemoglobin. So red bone marrow needs iron, right, which is just a little metal ion. It needs a vitamin. It needs vitamin B12. We call that cobalamin, because an important part of cobalamin is really cobalt. Cobalt is another metal ion. It's just kind of strange to think that your body needs something like cobalt, but you need it in very small quantities in order to make, what, red blood cells. Cobalamin is the vitamin that's necessary for cell division. Yeah. Maybe. I'm not quite so sure exactly how it helps with your energy level. Okay, there might be a little bit different mechanism, but vitamin B12 is necessary in order for you to build new cells to replace old and damaged ones. So not just blood, but every kind of cell. When it's proliferating, replacing old and damaged cells, you need vitamin B12. Okay. There's another vitamin called folic acid. That's necessary to produce red blood cells as well. All right, so if you're deficient in any one of these things, then you will become anemic. Okay, so cobalt is that funny little metal ion that we need in our diet. Can't produce cobalt. All right, so red blood cell production can be stimulated by low oxygen concentration in your body. So there are places that measure oxygen concentration, and low oxygen concentration might be due to a decreased number of red blood cells that are in your circulation, for instance. Or decreased oxygen concentration could be due to maybe a defective hemoglobin. Maybe your body isn't making the hemoglobin necessary. Maybe it's making red blood cells, but not the hemoglobin that goes into it. So when somebody is anemic, we have to decide what the problem is. Is it due to a decreased production of red blood cells or maybe hemoglobin right here? And of course, if somebody has lung disease, if they have asthma or emphysema or something like that, they can't get oxygen into their lungs, then that's going to produce a low oxygen concentration. Or if somebody lives at high altitude, right, they're going to have decreased oxygen in their body. So we don't worry about that around here very much. But what cities are really high in altitude? They're a mile above sea level. We're right at sea level, but some cities are a mile above sea level. And when you live in those areas, your body compensates by even making more red blood cells. So your hematocrit is elevated. It might be around 46 or 47 or 48%. So that helps you transport oxygen in your blood. Does anybody know some cities that are really high in altitude? I'm not sure I could quite hear you with the fan right here. But there's one in the United States that's really high. It's a major city. That's Denver, Colorado. Okay. Did you say Denver? Oh, yeah, Colorado. Boulder, Colorado. Denver, Colorado. That's almost a mile high above sea level. All right, so people's hematocrits are elevated there. But, for instance, others would be Lima, Peru in the Andes. That's really high. That's a huge city. And Mexico City, that's another really huge city. That's high up in altitude. Okay. So it certainly happens. All right, or if somebody has heart or vascular disease where they can't transport oxygen, that's going to produce low oxygen in their blood, and that's going to result in an increased hematocrit. And then, of course, people that exercise very strenuously, endurance training, since they're using up oxygen to make ATP, all right, they're going to have an elevated hematocrit as well. So don't forget, the hematocrit is just a percent of red blood cell volume that we find in whole blood. Okay, so how can we make blood? What's necessary to make red blood cells? It's controlled by a hormone. Yeah, erythropoietin. Okay. So for instance, if you have any of these things in your life, like cardiovascular disease, right? If you live at high altitude, or if you exercise very heavily and your oxygen decreases in your body, right? There are two organs that can monitor oxygen in your body. So low blood oxygen is perceived by the liver as well as the kidney. And these two organs can release a hormone called erythropoietin. Sounds a little funny, all right? And erythropoietin is released into the bloodstream, and it goes everywhere in the body, and in particular, red bone marrow. So here's a nice, this looks like a femur, and we can see the medullary cavity. And in this individual, it probably what looks nice and red in there, hopefully. So that's red bone marrow. Erythropoietin is going to stimulate the production of red blood cells. And as these red blood cells are released into the blood, what happens to the oxygen concentration inside the body. Remember, we started with low oxygen concentration, but as there is an increased number of red blood cells, what happens to oxygen concentration? It increases, right? And as it increases, that goes to the liver and the kidney, and the liver and the kidney say, oh, gee whiz, well, oxygen concentration now is normal, and so the liver and kidney stop secreting erythropoietin, and that just brings the level of red blood cells or the hematocrit back to normal. All right, so the liver and kidney actually monitor the oxygen concentration. Erythropoietin, I think way back at the beginning when somebody was really anemic years and years ago, we would actually get the erythropoietin from cadavers and inject that into people. Okay, today we don't have to do that because we know where the gene is, what part of a chromosome is responsible for making erythropoietin, and somebody took a bacterium and inserted that gene into that bacteria, and now these bacteria all day long just make erythropoietin for us in a test tube, and we grab that erythropoietin out of a test tube and can give it to somebody that is anemic. Right, so through genetic engineering, we've turned that into a nice industrial process so we don't have to grind up anybody's liver and kidney to get erythropoietin anymore. And that drug is called EPO. EPO is the genetically engineered erythropoietin that comes from bacteria. And that's a lot cheaper, too. And you don't have to wait for somebody to die to get erythropoietin. So it's more readily available, and it's probably better for people, too, because you don't have to worry about getting any kind of diseases, for instance, from a cadaver. So if you get a transplant from somebody, a human tissue, what kind of diseases might you have to worry about? Like AIDS, hepatitis, things of that nature, okay? Okay, so since a red blood cell doesn't last for very long in your body, it gets broken down. All right, so let's talk about how it's broken down in the body. Okay, so here's the red bone marrow that's making red blood cells. And when they die, red blood cells are broken down pretty much by the liver. All right, and so when they're broken down, that releases hemoglobin. That's the compound that carries oxygen in your blood. Your liver breaks hemoglobin down into two parts, globin and heme. And globin is a protein. So globin is a protein. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So your body can break down globin into amino acids. I'm just going to abbreviate it AA. And then what can your body do with these amino acids? It can make more proteins out of them, whatever kinds of proteins that your body needs. So that's real handy. This heme, though, is a different kind of molecule. It's difficult to break down. Heme contains both iron and a big organic molecule. So heme gets broken down into iron and a chemical compound we call biliverdin. This iron right here can be recycled to make more red blood cells or make more hemoglobin. But this biliverdin has to be excreted from your body. It's converted into bilirubin, and it's put in the bile, and bile then is secreted into the intestine. And then, of course, you just lose that whenever you defecate. Right? So that's how it leaves your body. This bilirubin right here is actually bright yellow. It's a pigment. It's a bright yellow compound. And when somebody is breaking down a lot of red blood cells, right, or maybe they have liver damage where bilirubin is building up, they have a condition called jaundice as a result, okay, because that bilirubin is a bright yellow color. So their fingernails might be yellow, the whites of their eyes will be yellow, and sometimes when somebody's on chemotherapy for various kinds of tumors, that poisons their liver and they become jaundiced as a result of that. That's just one of the side effects of chemotherapy. Okay? So anytime red blood cells are broken down too fast for the liver to process, they become jaundiced as a result of this chemical compound right here, which we call bilirubin. Okay. So try to remember how hemoglobin is broken down into. Hemoglobin is broken down into heme and globin. Globin is just a protein, so that's easy to recycle into your body. The heme is broken down into iron and biliverdin, and your body can reuse that iron and that bilirubin we have to excrete, okay, in feces. And that bilirubin is a nice yellow color. Okay. So that's pretty much it for red blood cells. White blood cells are white because they don't contain hemoglobin. So again, tell me, what's the function of hemoglobin again? And what kind of cell has hemoglobin? Its job is to carry oxygen. And what kind of cells are loaded with hemoglobin again? Red blood cells, right. All right, white blood cells, on the other hand, don't contain hemoglobin, so their function is not to carry oxygen, but it is to fight infections. So white blood cells are important for your immune system to fight infections. White blood cells remove dead cells and debris from tissues by phagocytosis. All right, so what does phagocytosis again look like? I don't have a picture of it. Yeah, it's when a cell actually surrounds some kind of particle or another cell and ingests it, all right, and just absorbs it into its own cellular structure and then digests it once it's inside the cell. All right, so you should be aware that there are five different kinds of white blood cells. There are neutrophils, monocytes, lymphocytes, and then a couple others, basophils and eosinophils. All right, neutrophils, they're the most common, so that when you look at a picture of blood and you see a white blood cell, it's mostly going to be a neutrophil all the time. And that's important for phagocytosis, and whenever you have an infection someplace, you're going to have many, many thousands of neutrophils going to that area, and they phagocytize what's ever there, and they could die, and that's what forms pus at the site of an infection. Okay, monocytes are the largest, and a monocyte is interesting because it's a shapeshifter. It can change its shape, and it's crawling around inside your body between cells and even in the spaces of your lung all the time. And when it leaves the circulatory system, we call it a macrophage, and it phagocytizes particles that are in tissue spaces. So for instance, here we have a blood vessel, maybe like a capillary. Here's a little space between the cells that make up the capillary, and here we see a white blood cell actually crawling out of the blood looking for things to phagocytize. Right, so that would be a monocyte when it's inside the circulatory system, but as soon as it crawls out, then we call that a macrophage, because it's just what? Macrophage just means big eater. It's looking for stuff to consume all the time that doesn't belong in your body. Another kind of white blood cell is a lymphocyte. And guess what part of your body a lymphocyte is most generally associated with? It's the lymph, yeah, like lymph nodes, for instance, right? But it's a white blood cell. It starts in the blood. It plays an important role in the body's immune response. It can make antibodies, which are chemicals that fight infection, all right? But it can also kill pathogens just by touching them, by contact killing. So we're going to look at lymphocytes when we get to the immune system. So when I say lymphocyte, you should just automatically say, oh, that's one of the kinds of white blood cells that we have in our body to fight infection. And we'll see how it does that. These basophils and eosinophils, we don't talk about very much, but they're involved with an inflammatory response. So when tissue swells up, when it gets red, when it gets hot, it's due to these kinds of cells right here. So probably the three that you're most interested in are neutrophils, because they're the most common. Macrophages, or these monocytes, are real interesting because they can crawl around anywhere in your body, including your lungs, and lymphocytes because they're associated with your lymphatic system. But nonetheless, they all help fight infection. Okay. All right, the next kind of compound, or the next formed element that we're interested in, is a thrombocyte. What's another name for a thrombocyte? That's a platelet. And platelets are real important because they function in preventing blood loss. So that's another important function of blood, not only just to flow around in your body to transport nutrients and oxygen and things like that, but another important function of blood is to stop bleeding whenever a blood vessel gets damaged or torn. So these are small cell fragments consisting of a small amount of cytoplasm surrounded by a cell membrane. They're not really a cell because they don't have a nucleus, but they do have cytoplasm, right? And they play a really important role in preventing blood loss. So to prevent blood loss, it can happen in one of two different ways. There's something called a platelet plug. This is for small rips or tears in a blood vessel. And guess what it needs? Platelets. All right. And the second kind of prevention of blood loss is called blood clotting. This is for larger tears, larger disruptions in the circulatory system. Okay, so platelet plug. Let's talk about that first. All right, this is when the epithelium is torn and it reveals some underlying collagen fibers. All right, so the epithelium is just the part that lines every blood vessel. So here is a capillary. All right, so here is a capillary right here, and a capillary is very thin. It really only has an epithelium. It doesn't have any other layers. So whenever a capillary is torn, guess what the blood can come in contact with? Connective tissue. And what are these fibers in connective tissue called? The name, that is collagen, right? So when platelets come up against this chemical compound, collagen, it releases factors so that platelets get sticky. Collagen fibers cause platelets to get sticky, and they accumulate at the site of that tear. And that just has a tendency to close that tear in a blood vessel. So activated or sticky platelets release factors such as compounds like prostaglandins. Maybe you've heard of prostaglandins. And these chemical compounds like prostaglandins and calcium ions activate more platelets, which then completely seals that little tear off. Now there's a drug that people used to take very commonly that's a prostaglandin synthesis inhibitor. And it's also really good for headaches. It's really good for pain in your body. Aspirin, for instance, right? You were reading my mind. Very good, right? So aspirin has many, many different effects in your body, but it prevents the synthesis of prostaglandins. Guess what else it can be used for? Preventing these platelet plugs from forming. All right, so that's why it's used sometimes for people whose systems are a little bit overaggressive in producing blood clots, or people that are prone to having heart attacks, because it can inhibit this prostaglandin synthesis and it kind of acts like sort of a blood thinner. Okay. Okay, so that might be good for some people, but maybe not good for other people who are concerned. For instance, if you're going to be traveling someplace, maybe you're going to go out in the wilderness camping or something. Might you be a little bit concerned if you cut yourself, you're going to have trouble stopping that bleeding, for instance? Then that's a good time not to be taking a lot of aspirin. And it takes about 2 weeks for your body to recover from that. Or if you're going to go on a sailing trip, say, for here to Hawaii or around the world or something, and you might hit your head on a part of the sailboat or something, you probably don't want to be on a lot of aspirin because you're going to have a tendency to bleed. Okay. Or, for instance, surgery, right. Maybe even a dental procedure. If you're going to get a crown on a tooth and they're going to be doing some kind of procedure on a tooth or any kind of surgery, you don't want to be on aspirin because you're going to prevent these platelets from working to their best degree, and you'll have a tendency to bleed more than normal. Okay. The second kind of prevention of blood loss is what we call blood clotting. Okay. But blood clotting really has another more scientific name, and that's called coagulation. So that's how I want you to know blood clotting. And blood clotting is due to the production of a chemical that we call fibrin. So coagulation produces fibrin. Fibrin is a protein that's in your blood. right? And the fibrin forms a network that traps all kinds of different things as blood flows through it. Red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, or whatever else, right? So a clot is a network of these thread-like protein fibers, which are called fibrin. And that traps blood cells, platelets, and fluid. Coagulation is a three-step process that I'm going to show you in just a second, okay? So if you cut yourself, and this is for, what, a serious kind of injury to a blood vessel. If you have a serious injury to a blood vessel, would you like to stop bleeding right away? Or, you know, in a couple hours, or by tomorrow, or next week? Or how quickly would you like to stop that blood loss? Yeah, very quickly. Okay? All right, so if your body had to make fibrin by turning on protein synthesis, all right, as soon as you cut yourself, if all of a sudden you had to go through all the steps of transcription and translation in order to make these proteins, it could take you days or even a week to make enough fibrin to stop that blood loss. So your body uses another kind of scheme. Your body uses, all right, it makes a form of fibrin that's inactive and puts it in your blood. And that inactive form can be converted into an active form very quickly. So you don't have to actually build these proteins, all right, from amino acids. You just have to convert them from an active form to an inactive form to an active form, and that's relatively quick. That can happen very quickly. So I want to tell you about some nomenclature. All right, if we have a protein that can catalyze a reaction, we call that an enzyme. Okay, and if you ever see an enzyme with a PRO at the front of it over here as a prefix, that just means that this enzyme is in your body, but it is in an inactive form. So a proenzyme is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form very easily by maybe modifying it somehow, or chopping it in half, or chopping some little piece of that enzyme off, and it can become active. So whenever you hear pro something, proenzyme, that means inactive, but ready to go to work at a split second notice. The same thing, if we have another protein, if you see ogen at the end of it as a suffix, that also means that it is inactive. But it can be converted into an active form very, very quickly if you ever need it in a hurry. So if you needed a lot of this protein, it might take 2 weeks for your body to build it. But your body can build a lot of it, stick it in your blood in an inactive form, and it can be converted into an active form at a moment's notice. Right? So that's really handy. They have proenzymes or proteinogens that can become active very quickly. This is certainly important for coagulation, for blood clotting. All right, so step one is what we call prothrombin activator formation. So when you see that term prothrombin, can you tell me, is prothrombin active or inactive? If inactive, because of you see that PRO, right? The thrombin is really the active part of it, all right? So this first part is what we call prothrombin activator formation. So here is stage one. So stage one always starts with injury to a blood vessel, ripping the epithelium so that, for instance, platelets can contact collagen or other kinds of chemicals in connective tissue outside the blood vessel. So injury to a blood vessel exposes connective tissue to the blood, and chemicals are released into the blood. These chemicals can take inactive clotting factors and convert them into active clotting factors. So your body doesn't have to start building clotting factors, because if it had to start building clotting factors, you'd bleed to death by the time your body built them up to the right degree. All right, so now you have active clotting factors, right? And in the presence of chemicals that come from platelets and calcium, that produces prothrombin activator. Okay, so here is something else that's really important for you to appreciate. Before you took this class, you probably had an idea of why calcium is important in your body. Why is it important in your body? Because it makes strong bones, right? Okay? But you also have to have the proper level of calcium in your blood, because if you ever cut yourself, you would bleed to death if you didn't have the proper level of calcium. Okay, so I suppose I could ask you a question. What do you think is more important, to have really strong bones or the ability to stop bleeding when you cut yourself? Yeah, it's kind of a nice toss-up, gee whiz. I want to have both. And sometimes as we get older, it's hard to have both at the same time. We have trouble as we get older to maintain calcium in our bodies. And when your body runs out of calcium to prevent blood loss, it goes to bones to get it so that you don't bleed to death. Okay, so calcium is real important for stopping blood loss. All right, so now you have prothrombin activator. What the heck does that do? That takes us to stage two. Prothrombin activator, all right, works on a protein in your blood called prothrombin. All right, so prothrombin, you told me, is what? Inactive. And it's an enzyme. Okay, and it becomes active when prothrombin activator is available from stage one. Prothrombin activator just converts prothrombin into thrombin. Okay, and what can you tell me about thrombin? Is it active or inactive? It's active. So now it gets turned on and it can start doing something for you. It's an enzyme. And that takes us to stage three. This isn't really too complicated. Thrombin is an enzyme that can convert fibrinogen. And by looking at fibrinogen, can you tell me, is it active or inactive? It is inactive. And it's the job of thrombin to convert fibrinogen into the active form, which is fibrin. And fibrin is the chemical compound that actually stops bleeding when you injure a blood vessel. So let me show you what fibrin really looks like. You have a good picture in your book. All right. Fibrinogen is a protein that's very soluble in plasma. It can dissolve. And when I say soluble, what does that mean? When you take a sugar cube and put it in some hot tea or coffee, what happens to that sugar cube? It dissolves. It goes away, right? It just flows right into solution very nicely. The same thing for fibrinogen. It dissolves in blood and flows everywhere in blood because it doesn't have much structure. It just dissolved in blood. But when fibrinogen is converted into fibrin, it precipitates out. It's no longer soluble. Fibrin becomes a solid and forms a solid mesh inside your cardiovascular system. And it looks like this. Okay, so these are all the fibrin fibers or threads that form a network, and it traps red blood cells and it traps platelets and white blood cells. And so this meshwork right here seals over that cut or forms a blood clot. So what's the name of that process that forms fibrin? What is that called? We call it blood clotting, but the more proper term is what we call coagulation. Okay, and coagulation has got that three-step process. Okay, so when you think of coagulation, the bottom line is you should think of fibrin formation, the formation of this network right here. Okay, so coagulation and fibrin formation are pretty much really the same kind of thing. Okay, so you needed clotting factors. Where do clotting factors come from? They're made in the liver. So in order to have good blood clotting function, you have to have a healthy liver. If the liver is damaged, you're going to have tendency to bleed. Many require vitamins. Many of these clotting factors require vitamins, and one vitamin is vitamin K. That's not K like potassium. It's not the ion in your body, but that's a vitamin. So if you don't have, where do you get vitamins from? Can your body make vitamins? Can't. You have to have vitamins in your diet, right? And do you know what kind of foods contain a lot of vitamin K? It's green leafy vegetables and even broccoli. I know I see a lot of people making funny faces, okay? But that's where you get vitamin K from. So unless you take a multivitamin, if you don't have green leafy vegetables, a good example would be broccoli, then you're going to have decreased blood clotting function. As a result of that, you're going to have a tendency to bleed. And I know when my nephews were real young, There were three little boys really close to age, and they'd horse around all the time. And they would get a bloody nose, right? Somebody would get elbowed in the nose, and they'd come over and say, "Oh, Uncle Joe, look at my nose, it's bleeding. And so I'd tell them, "Okay, well, you know, hold your nose, stop horsing around, and it will stop." But they would get bloody noses all the time. But during supper time, okay, I would tell them, you know, to prevent bloody noses, you have to eat broccoli and green beans and things like that. And they would just kind of look at me like I was crazy, have no idea what I was talking about, okay? And so my nephews would rather have bled to death than eat broccoli when they were younger, okay? But that tells you something else too, and that is, for instance, some people might be on Coumadin therapy. Maybe they're having trouble with blood clots in certain parts of their body. It might be due to maybe their heart isn't functioning properly, or circulation in their legs aren't proper. So they need to take Coumadin, which interrupts this mechanism right here in forming blood clots, so they don't get blood clots. And you don't really want blood clots unless you have a hole in a blood vessel, because if you have a blood clot and you don't have a hole in a blood vessel, that clot can go to, say, your brain, cut off blood supply to your brain and produce a stroke, or it can go to your heart and produce a heart attack. So your body, you shouldn't be making clots, right, unless there's a good reason. So some people are on Coumadin to bring this function down a little bit. And so they have to be very concerned about the foods that they eat. For instance, if they eat broccoli 1 week, okay, they should eat broccoli the next week. They can't change their diet because Coumadin is so sensitive that it is adjusted, all right, week-to-week kind of basis. And if they change their diet, then the amount of Coumadin or heparin that somebody's taking has to be adjusted. All right, so actually, green leafy vegetables have a huge impact on blood clotting function. All right, so what are the things you need in your diet? Calcium, or impaired blood clotting function could be due to decreased number of platelets, or liver disease as well. All right, so that says something about, so what's the scientific name for this process right here?
Coagulation.
Yeah, coagulation. And the bottom line, coagulation is due to the formation of fibrin, and that comes from the activation of thrombin. Right, and thrombin is activated by prothrombin activator, and prothrombin activator occurs or is activated when there is tissue damage, and platelets release chemicals and calcium that activates prothrombin activator. Hemophilia, there's a couple different kinds, but hemophilia is up in this region over here when certain blood clotting factors aren't produced in the body. So these parts are working fine, but hemophilia doesn't allow the formation of prothrombin activator. All right, so hemophilia is a genetic disorder that somebody inherits from their parents, and their coagulation or blood clotting function is way reduced. Right, so they can't produce fibrin as a result of that. So a hemophiliac, somebody suffering from hemophilia, if they get a paper cut that's deep enough to bleed, they could actually bleed to death from just a little paper cut. So that's a really dangerous circumstance, and typically people with hemophilia don't live very long as a result of that. Okay, and one of the treatments is for hemophilia is to give them blood products from other people. So they would get clotting factors and platelets. Somebody would donate blood, and then we would get these factors and transfuse them into somebody that has hemophilia to help them, help their blood clotting function. But remember, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, there was a disease that was transmitted by the blood, and we didn't know about this disease for about 3 or 4 years. And most of the hemophiliacs came down with this disease and as a result died from the disease. And I don't think there are very many hemophiliacs alive today because this disease was so effective at just wiping that population out. What disease was that? It was HIV, right? Because for years and years and years, we didn't even know HIV existed and weren't testing for the AIDS virus in blood products. And so a lot of people got AIDS from transfusions way back when, before we even knew there was an AIDS virus. Yeah. Unfortunately. Okay. All right, so that is coagulation. That is preventing blood loss. So what are some important things? Don't forget, if you see something, a word with a pro at the beginning of it, that means it's inactive. Or ogen, that's inactive, but it can be converted into an active form right away. All right, maybe I want to say just something really fast about this. I don't know if it's in your notes. All right, but so your body has to produce a clot very quickly if you have damage to a blood vessel. But for instance, if you do get a paper cut on your finger over here, all right, you want to stop bleeding really quickly with this at the site where it's been injured on this finger, but you want a blood clot in your other hand, for instance, or some other part of your body. No, you want that blood clot to occur just where that site of injury is and nowhere else. So there's got to be a mechanism to contain coagulation, to make sure that it doesn't run rampant and produce clots all over your body. All right, so a thrombus is just what we call a blood clot in a blood vessel someplace. All right, that's a thrombus. An embolus is a clot that floats around in a vessel, and it can become lodged as vessels get smaller and smaller and smaller. Right? So emboli can cause serious illness and death. When it plugs up a blood vessel, that means oxygen can't get to that tissue, and that tissue is going to die. And this happened to, there was a reporter, news reporter, that went to, I think, Iraq, when there was a war in Iraq, and there were a lot of hostilities, and so everybody was afraid to get out of their armored vehicle. So he just sat in his armored vehicle for about a week and a half. And whenever blood is not moving in your body, it has a tendency to solidify or form a clot. And that clot dislodged from wherever it was and went to his lungs, and it blocked part of his lungs. Right? We call that a pulmonary embolism. And as a matter of fact, he died as a result of that pulmonary embolism. So proper physical activity is important for good function of your blood as well. And some people even get a pulmonary embolism if they fly long distances. For instance, if they fly from like maybe L.A. to Denpasar or someplace. Where's Denpasar at? That's Indonesia, really far away. That's like a 12 or 16 hour, no, not 12, at least 16 hours. Flying, and when you're in an airplane, what are you doing? You're just sitting there, right? Or if you're flying from LA to London or something, people can get embolisms where blood clot goes to the lungs and it kills their lungs. So let's talk about that process for a little bit. Okay, and that is, how do you limit clot formation normally in the body? Well, there is an enzyme called plasmin. And the job of plasmin is to find fibrin or a clot and break it down to just dissolve fibrin in your body. Okay, so clots are dissolved by plasma, by that plasma protein or enzyme called plasmin. And again, your body doesn't wait around to build plasmin when it's necessary. It's making it all the time, and it's storing it in your blood as plasminogen. And is plasminogen active or inactive? It's inactive, right? But it's ready to go to work at a moment's notice. So here's that thrombin molecule again. Thrombin is an enzyme that can convert plasminogen into plasmin. So the thing that actually causes a blood clot causes what the limits as to how much clot your body can actually make. So it makes plasmin. Right? There's another compound called tissue plasminogen activator that can be activated as well. We call that TPA. And we're actually using this clinically right now because there are people that get blood clots in parts of their body where they shouldn't have them, like in the brain, that's going to cause a stroke, or in their heart, that's a heart attack. All right? And if they go to the right place and it's diagnosed quickly and properly, they can be given TPA or even another drug from a bacterium called streptokinase. They can be given this, and it erases that stroke before it really kills a lot of their brain. So only very sophisticated hospitals, probably like Memorial, right, Cedars-Sinai in LA, can come up with the right diagnosis and inject these things into somebody, and that prevents a heart attack or prevents a stroke. And that's really a marvelous kind of thing. All right, so TPA can reverse the effects of a stroke if given early on. So if you know anybody who's experiencing symptoms of a heart attack or a stroke, right, it's important that they get to the hospital soon, right away, so that this therapy can reverse the effects of their pathology, right? Don't wait around overnight, because a lot of times when somebody's experiencing a stroke, they have a tendency to say, oh, well, maybe it was something I ate, or it's this, that, or the other thing, and they don't seek medical attention. And by that time, it's too late to give them these kinds of drugs that would just wipe out that pathology and save them a lot of grief and agony, right? So if you know somebody in your family experiencing these things and they don't like to see doctors, you have to really, you know, guide them to see somebody that will help them out. Yeah. Oh, you know, I'm not familiar with that test. Little stroke test?
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but that sure would be handy to know. Oh, yeah, okay. That certainly makes sense. Okay, but I'm not familiar with that test. I'd like to do a Google on that and find out what that test is. Yeah, because you could save somebody's life, you know, very, very easily. Okay. All right, let's see. What page was that? 7. Okay. All right, last page. All right, what we have to talk about right now is blood typing. So you might be aware that different people have different blood types in their body, and depending on your blood type, you can't get a transfusion from just anybody because it can produce what we call a transfusion reaction. All right, so if you need blood, maybe you've had a hemorrhage of some kind, and you need a transfusion, we have to put the proper kind of blood in you, otherwise it's going to clump together. And that clumping is a little bit different kind of process than coagulation. So again, for coagulation, what produces coagulation? What's the molecule that produces coagulation for us?
Fibrin.
Yeah, fibrin. It's that mesh, right? It's that network. Okay? But blood typing is not due to fibrin formation, it's due to a different kind of process. Right? A transfusion reaction is an interaction between antigens and antibodies. So I want to talk about antigens and antibodies for just a little bit. It's a totally different kind of thing than fibrin formation, which is that mesh or network. Okay, so remember, we've got two main parts in blood. We've got cells, which we call formed elements, and we have plasma. So for transfusion reactions, please remember that antigens are found on the cells, on the cell membranes, and antibodies are found in plasma. So here you can see I made like a little diagram of a cell right here, a red blood cell. And these little squiggle lines just means it's what? Like the water stuff, right? It's just like little waves. Okay, that's the water part. All right, so let me draw some things on the board. What does that look like? That looks like an erythrocyte, right? That's a red blood cell, okay? And on the surface of the red blood cell, do we have antigens or antibodies? We have antigens. So sticking off the cell surface, there are molecules, and these molecules have different shapes to them, all right? And we can talk about the shapes in different ways. And somebody was looking at molecules sticking off of red blood cell plasma membrane, and they were able to identify one. So it's the first one that they were able to identify. So guess what they called it? They could call it number one, but they didn't. So the next best thing is that they called it A. Okay, the first one they found. All right, so here is some kind of molecule that has a shape. It doesn't necessarily have to look like an A. It's just the first one that we could characterize, so we call it A. All right, so it has many of them sticking off the cell membrane. All right, and so these are what? Antigens. These are antigens right here. And all cells have antigens because these are signatures or addresses that define where this cell belongs to, what body it belongs to, if it's you or your cousin or somebody else. And As a matter of fact, this A is very similar in all of us that have it. We have other antigens on our cell membranes that are much different compared to anybody else in the world. All right, so these define what person this blood cell belongs to. And then they started looking for more and more antigens, and they found another one that was different. And it was sticking off the cell membrane. So guess what they called the second one they found? They call it B. And it's a different shape. Not that it looks like a B, but it's just a different shape than A. And then they found some red blood cells that didn't have any A antigens or B antigens on them at all. In terms of the A and B antigens, it was just plain. So guess what they call that one? They could maybe call that one C, but they probably would want to call it zero, but it didn't make sense. You couldn't say A, letter B, and zero, because zero is a number, so it wasn't very consistent. So guess what they said? They said, oh, let's call it O instead. Okay? So these are how we define blood types in people. The blood type that a person has is determined by the antigens that are on the surface of their red blood cells. So if somebody has blood type A, guess what they have? Only the A antigen. If somebody has blood type B, they only have the B antigen on the surface of their red blood cells. And if they're blood type O, guess what they have? They have nothing. They have neither antigen on the surface of their red blood cells. And that probably shows you what the other kind of blood type is. You've got A, you got B, and O, and the last blood type is if you have both antigens on the surface of your red blood cell. And what blood type is that? That's called AB, right? So you got A, you got B, AB, and O. Those are the possible blood types for what we call the ABO system. There are other kinds of antigens that maybe we will talk about, but this is just for the ABO system. Okay, but we said, let's see if I can get that back down over here. Yeah. But we said that a transfusion reaction is due to an interaction between an antigen and something else. What was the something else? An antibody. All right, so where do we find antibodies? On the membrane of this, in the plasma, dissolved in the plasma. And I'm not going to draw it to scale, but an antibody sort of looks like this. You can almost think of a body. So here is the trunk of somebody. Here are a couple arms sticking out. And then some hands right here. Here are some hands reaching up. So an antibody has these two parts. And the hands can grab onto something. Guess what they can grab onto? They can grab onto the antigens right here. All right, and they grab onto it by shape. Right, the shape has to be complementary. So for instance, here is an antibody. And is this going to be, what kind of antibody is this? Let me draw it for you. All right, so here is an antibody. And these two hands have to be the same. They can't be different. Here is another kind of antibody. Here's a second kind of antibody. It's got the two arms. Two hands right here, right? And now this one looks like this. You see a similarity in shape at all between this hand here and the antigens? What can fit into this thing, A or B? B, okay? Because a B can do what? It can fit right into, for instance, this active site right here. All right, so this one right here is what we call antibody B, or B antibody. And what about this one? What can fit in here? An A can fit in here. But can a B fit into this one? No. So this is what we call anti-A, or antibody A, because it just matches up by shape. Okay. So let's where do you find these antibodies again? In the plasma. And antigens you find on the cell surface. All right, cell surface. And when there's a transfusion reaction, that's when we mix the improper components. We mix anti-A with somebody that has A antigens. So what can happen? So when that happens, here is what? One antibody. And here is the other hand over here, right? And what can bind here? Okay, another A that's on another cell. Okay, another red blood cell. And here is an A here. Now what can bind here? Another antibody that can bind what? Another cell. So because of these antibodies match up with the antigens, you can start sticking thousands of cells together. And when you stick thousands of cells together, they can't flow through your circulatory system. They clump together because antibodies start gluing cells together because the shape of the antigen matches up with the antibody. This process right here, when cells start to clump together because they're bound by antibodies, this is what we call agglutination. So agglutination is what? An antigen-antibody reaction where cells start to clump together. It's different than coagulation because what is coagulation again? What does it look like? Fibrin formation. That's coagulation. But agglutination, let's see if I got a picture of what agglutination looks like. Yeah, here is agglutination. Right, here is agglutination. Red blood cells are just sticking together because antibodies are gluing cells together because the improper blood was given to them. All right, so how can you remember this? Well, let's make a little table. I think we have put a table in your book, but this is instructive to do this. Let me see if I can remember how to put this table together. All right, so here is a table. And over here, the first line, let's put antigen. All right, so where do we find antigens again? Cell membrane. Right? I'm just going to abbreviate it, cell membrane. And what's the other part of a transfusion reaction? It's antigen and antibody. Where do we find antibodies at? Plasma. Here we have plasma. All right. So this is part of our table right here. Now what are the different kinds of blood types we have? We've got blood type A. Blood type B, we got AB, and we got zero, which everybody calls what? O. That's right, O. Okay, blood type. So this is a blood type right here. Now let's fill in this table like this. All right, so person with blood type A, what kind of antigens do they have? This is how we define blood type, right? They've got to have antigen A. All right, so they've got antigen A. What about antigen B? Nope. Okay. But they do have some antibodies. Can this person with blood type A have anti-A in their blood? No, because if they did, what would happen to the red blood cells? They'd all clump together. Right, it would agglutinate. So they don't have anti-A, they have anti-B. Antibody B floating around in their blood. Okay. Now let's think about blood type B. What kind of antigen does somebody with blood type B have? They've got B antigens. What about the antibody? Can they have anti-B in their blood? No way. They have anti-A in their blood. So if we mix these two kinds of bloods, then agglutination is going to take place, right? What about somebody with blood type AB? What about their antigens? They have both A and B antigens. So don't forget where these antigens are. Where are these antigens at again? The cell membrane. What about antibodies in the plasma? Can they have any antibodies in their plasma? No. Right? So say no antibodies. No antibodies. And what about blood type O? What kind of antigens do they have? None. Right? So no antigens. And what about antibodies? They have actually anti-A and anti-B. Right? So you would say both. Both anti-A or antibody A and antibody B. So during the test, if you're thinking of these things, you could probably generate that table as long as you can remember what? Where the antigens belong. That's the easiest place to start. They belong on the cell membrane, and whatever antigen somebody has, that's their blood type. All right, so another way that I like to test for this is actually give you a red blood cell and tell me what the blood type of that person is. All right, so I could give you, this is a nice red color too. Okay, so here is a red blood cell. So what's the blood type of this person here? That's blood type A, because that's the antigen that they have. All right, so then I'll kind of erase it real quick. What's the blood type of this person here? AB. That's that person's blood type AB. All right, and then if I give you this on the test, you would say B. And then if I give you this person's blood, you're going to say O. So it's actually fairly simple to see that, right? Okay. Okay, so that's the ABO system. So don't forget, the agglutination is due to what? An antigen-antibody reaction. But what about coagulation? Coagulation. What does coagulation do to? Fibrin formation. Fibrin formation. That's not antibody-antigen reaction. Fibrin formation. Right, fibrin formation. Okay. All right, I do need to talk about one last blood group system. All right, so this is just the ABO. For instance, if you walked into a hospital and maybe you got into a car accident or something and you started to hemorrhage, and you walked into a hospital and said, hey, I need a transfusion reaction right away. I've had a hemorrhage. I'm ready to pass out. I know my blood type. I'm blood type A. Are they going to believe you and hook and start transfusing blood type A into you? No, because if you're wrong, what's going to happen? They're going to kill you. And guess who's responsible? It's the hospital. So the ABO system is just one of some very important blood group systems. And they all have to match up, not just the ABO system. Another important blood type system is called the Rh system. Rh is a capital R and a little H right here. And it was discovered in rhesus monkeys, but humans have these kinds of proteins too. And so it was called Rh because it was first discovered in a little monkey. Okay, and so it's a nice monkey. All right, but it's actually simpler than the ABO system because when we talk about Rh, does anybody know how we can talk about Rh? Rh can be either positive or Rh can be negative. So guess what that means? The Rh is just the shape of the protein, the antigen. Where do we find antigens again? On the surface of a red blood cell. So that antigen, I'm just going to abbreviate Rh. It's going to have that kind of shape to it. All right, so here is Rh. So this kind of blood would be Rh positive. And what's the other kind? Negative. And what would that be? No Rh antigen on it. So if you have the antigen on the red blood cell, you're Rh positive. If there's no antigen, you're Rh negative. All right. So furthermore, now let's incorporate the ABO system on top of this as well. So what would be the blood type of this person in terms of the ABO system as well as the Rh? So this would be O negative. And what would this one be? O positive. All right. Now what would this person be? A positive. And then what would this person be? This person would be AB negative, right? Because it has both the A antigen, the B antigen, but no Rh. So that's how you look at these things. And I think it's maybe not enough time right now to talk about a condition that's real important, for instance, if someone is ever pregnant. That's a condition where a baby's blood is being destroyed because of an antibody antigen reaction between the fetus and the mom. That's called erythroblastosis fetalis, and that produces a newborn who's jaundiced. And that happens when the mom is Rh negative and the baby is Rh positive. Because what kind of antibodies can somebody with Rh negative make? It can make anti-Rh, and those antibodies can go from the mom into the fetus. All right, so the mom makes anti-Rh that goes into the fetus and destroys the red blood cells in the fetus before they're born. So we call that hemolytic disease of the newborn, or erythroblastosis fetalis. So it used to be when people got married, they had to get a blood type, because they were going to find out if the mom, if the female was negative and the male was positive, right? That could produce a fetus that had Rh positive blood, and the mom could develop antibodies against the fetus before it was born. All right? I think we don't have to do blood types anymore because it's so important, and people know now to check that whenever they're having a baby. Okay. It usually doesn't kill the baby. It's possible if a woman has been pregnant multiple times and she's really sensitized, but it can certainly produce a lot of neurological damage to the baby. All right, so you don't even want to get close to it. So even though it might not be fatal, it certainly produces very deleterious effects. Right? Okay. Okay, so I got the quiz for the weekend. So let's pass out the quiz. All right, so let's see. Just take one, pass them back. Take one, pass it back. Yeah, and then I'll get some extras. So sorry about not having the quiz ready for it. Well, it's ready for you today if you want it, but now we're done with blood. Have a nice weekend. Okay.